Hey there, welcome to MedTech Africa, the podcast where we showcase digital health and health technology innovations from across the African continent. My name is Sam Oti, and I'm your host. On today's show, I'm honored to have the founder and executive director of an organization known as Who Lives. And his name is John Renouard, based out of the United States in the state of Utah. We are going to be talking about an innovation that John and his team have developed that is saving lives by improving access to water across the developing world. Thank you for joining in and do enjoy the conversation. Hey there, welcome to MedTech Africa. I have an amazing guest on the show today. And look, I'm going to allow him to introduce himself. But first of all, let me ask him, where on earth are you at the moment, John?
Well, at the moment, I'm in the United States in the beautiful state of Utah. People are familiar with it because of the Utah Jazz.
Aha, yes, I remember the Utah Jazz from the days of Karl Malone.
Yes, back in the glory days, back when we had a competitive team. Yep.
Well, it's great to have you on the podcast. So let's start by you telling us a bit about yourself.
You bet, Sam. So, you know what? Most people describe me as just kind of a normal guy. I grew up and got, you know, normal grades. I grew up in the state of California, not too far away from Hollywood and just a few miles away from Disneyland. If any of your listeners have been to California, been to Disneyland, you've been within a couple miles of where I grew up. And I ended up going to college in the state of Utah. I went there with the purpose to play American football, but that dream fizzled pretty fast. And so I just continued with my studies and actually ended my collegiate career a little bit early to go to work in a construction company, managing a construction company. That lasted for several years. It was a great opportunity. And then I found myself in the field of real estate up in the state of Washington, which is the very northwest of the United States. And that became my career for about 20 years. And we did very, very well. We had a large company with anywhere from 400 to 600 employees working the real estate. And then back in the early 2000s, we ended up moving to the state of Utah. And that became a very fortuitous move for us because that is where this project that I've been involved with all started. And my involvement with other countries and helping other people all kind of derived from us living here in Utah. So again, a pretty normal background. My as you'll see, as we talk a little bit more, my background is more in finance than it is in engineering, yet we have created some incredible engineering projects and products that have really changed the world. So we'll get into that a little bit later, I'm sure.
Wow, that is a very fascinating story. And it doesn't sound normal from being born right next to Disneyland to almost being in college football and then in real estate. Honestly, that doesn't sound normal. I mean, it's great.
Yeah.
Well, really fascinating story. And thank you so much for making time to be on the podcast. So let's dive right into it. So you're really here to talk about this organization that you founded that is really making waves in the humanitarian sector. And it's called Who Lives, which is also quite a fascinating name. So can you tell us a bit about Who Lives? How did you even come up with that name? And what do you do?
You bet. So the WHO is actually an acronym for Water, Health, and Opportunity. And it just kind of felt good with Who Lives. And it really stemmed from my son, who again, back in the early 2000s, spent a couple of years in Kenya and Tanzania doing humanitarian and missionary work. And he returned after a couple of years. And then about 6 months later, my wife and a lot of my family went back over to Africa to kind of see what my oldest son had been up to for the last couple of years. And that was our first visit to the African continent. My wife and I had traveled extensively through South America, Central America, and some of the Caribbean countries, but we'd never been to Africa. And the one thing that kind of stood out for me was we knew we obviously were going to be in some areas where there was some poverty. But the one thing that struck me in particular was I had never experienced water poverty before. And believe it or not, it's a very, very different type of poverty. When you're basically enslaved every day to go and collect water, for survival, that's a very different situation than just not having enough money to buy your food or other things that you need. So that was the biggest thing that I noticed. And I noticed that burden fell on mostly women, and in many cases, very, very young women, preventing them from even going to school. And so water obviously was something that I noticed and said, man, if they could fix this problem, they would just be worlds ahead. And then, of course, we visited a lot of clinics and saw that that there was definitely some healthcare need. Now, ironically, the healthcare needs came from the fact that they were drinking a lot of dirty water. And so it just kind of felt natural that if you could fix the water problem, then almost by default, you fix at least half of the healthcare problem, because most of the people that were occupying the beds in these clinics were there because they had been drinking dirty and contaminated water. And then it became very evident that in those areas where people, they had water and they had good health, that the opportunities abound. The girls could go to school instead of fetching water all day. The men weren't getting sick. They weren't being brought down by malaria, so they could work and bring in that very important day's pay. And so the opportunity for women to become industrious and instead of fetching water, they could help with their children's homework and different things. And so that was kind of the progression. If you fix the water, you fix the health. If you fix the health, then you create opportunity. So that's the who of Who Lives. And we started this back in 2010. And here we are, geez, in 2024 when we're doing this podcast. So 14 years. And as you mentioned, we've been very, very blessed to have had a very large impact on over 40 countries around the world.
Wow, amazing stuff. And we'll be talking about the impact you've had very soon. But let me just pull up some statistics based on what you said about water poverty. So in Africa, yeah, 1 in 3 Africans are affected by water scarcity or poverty, as you put it. 411 million people on this continent still lack basic water drinking service. And 780 million lack access to basic sanitation services. So that is a big, big problem. And perhaps one that if you're in the middle class or, you know, you're well-to-do, you don't even really think about it very, very much. And yet there are millions of people across this continent for whom water is really, pun intended or no pun intended, a mm-hmm. pipe dream. Right. So, yeah. But I know that you've come up with an invention to solve this problem, and it's called the village drill. Please tell us about that.
You bet. So the village drill is a human powered drill that allows people to basically drill their own water wells for a fraction of the cost of conventional drilling. So I know a lot of NGOs out there are paying $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 for a single borehole. And for that same cost, that organization could actually purchase a village drill, own a village drill, and drill as many wells as they want to week after week after week, year after year.
So let's go into a bit more detail. Could you tell us what the village drill does and perhaps contrast it against what typically would happen if someone wanted to drill a borehole in a village somewhere?
Exactly. Great. So when you drill a borehole, basically what you're doing is putting a hole into the ground deep enough to reach what we call the aquifer. And over most of the world, aquifers are in a lot of places. Matter of fact, there's more aquifers in Africa than there are in the United States. There's more water under the ground in Africa than there is in all of the United States. So it's not a lack of water that Africa suffers from, it's lack of access. And primarily the lack of access comes from the prohibitive cost of what it takes for a community to drill one of these boreholes. Now, it's one thing, like you mentioned before, if you live in a big city, you have municipalities, so you can collect the water, or drill for the water, and then ship it out to the people of the community. But when you live far out in a rural village, well, how does that water get there? And so the idea of piping water to these rural areas is economically virtually impossible. And so they rely on boreholes. And again, so what a drill does, and whether it's a big giant truck that you see on the side of the road or drilling, all it is doing is putting about a 7-inch hole into the ground, typically around 100 to 300 feet, 400 feet into the ground to get into the aquifer. And then once you hit the aquifer, you take out the drill string, the drill bit, the cutting tool that drills the hole, you take that, and you can actually move that away and put it on another job. So now you have a hole in the ground, and then you take that borehole and you do what's called developing. You're going to develop that borehole. When you develop the borehole, you put down some plastic pipe, and you put in what's called gravel pack, and then in the center of that pipe, again, if you can imagine a 7-inch hole, you put in a 5-inch pipe, and then inside that 5-inch pipe, you usually put in a 3-inch pump. And that pump could be any sort of pump. It could be a hand pump that we typically see in the rural villages. It could be an electric pump that you see maybe closer to, you know, if there's power, they can use an electric pump or even solar pumps. And then when you develop that borehole, and now you can pull water out of that borehole almost nonstop, that's when we call it a well. So it starts out as a borehole, that's the drilling. And then once you drill the hole, take away the machine and develop it and put in a pump, now it's a well. And so those are kind of how we define the different terms that we use. Now, if you look at the village drill has a fairly small footprint. It's only 4 feet wide, 7 feet long, and it has a boom that sets up about 12 feet. But it's very transportable. You can take it apart and literally put all the pieces, including the drill string, in the back of your typical pickup truck. And so it's very, very, you can move it almost anywhere. All the parts are light enough that you can carry them by hand. So if a village is on a footpath, you can literally carry this in by hand, piece by piece. We were in the Congo, and we literally put the village drill in a canoe, and we paddled it up the Congo River for 3 days to arrive at the place that we were going to drill wells. So you can literally put this drilling machine into a canoe and travel it almost anywhere. So almost anywhere that people live, the village drill can get to it. And that's one of the, you know, access is one of the biggest issues we have, especially in these rural areas, because these huge, big, giant drilling trucks can't make it down a footpath. Heck, they can't make it down most roads if they're not, you know, paved or asphalt. And so the portability of the village drill really has set it apart. And the fact that it is human powered, and so you don't have to have electricity there to run it. You don't have these big giant generators polluting the earth, and you go and you can drill these boreholes. In many cases, everybody asks, well, how long does it take? Well, the average time it takes to drill a borehole is about 4 days, and that's it. And then after 4 days, if you're through drilling, then you will remove the village drill. You can move it to another site, and then you develop that borehole. The borehole actually takes as long to develop because you have to wait for the concrete pad to dry, which is usually 3 or 4 days. But usually within a week to 2 weeks' time, that village that never had clean water before now has access to that clean water. And I tell you, one other thing about the Village Drill, what makes it so unique is that it's very, very inexpensive to put in a well using this technology. So the way it ends up, and these are just averages. These are averages, but the average village will pay about $20 per person in order to get a well in their community. So let's say you have a community of 200 families. If each family pays $20, then that's $4,000, and that's more than enough to put in a finished well. And now the community has access to that. And one thing that Who Lives will do is actually finance that well for the village. As long as they put down a down payment, we'll put in we'll give a loan to that community, and each family is responsible for just paying $2 a month for the next 10 months, no interest, and now they've satisfied that obligation. And we know that in 90% of the cases, $2 a month is very affordable. So it's a very unique program that we've also developed that allows these almost any village to go and have access to clean water if they're willing to come together as a community and pledge to pay for that well to be put in.
Wow, that is absolutely amazing. Because I know, I mean, just even using the water rig, or what do they call those
big
trucks?
Big drill rigs.
Yeah, it could cost almost $20,000 to have a borehole. And here you are talking about $4,000. That is really a fraction. And especially when it's distributed across the community. But let me ask something a bit pragmatic. How do you enforce, you know, collecting that amount of money from everyone in the village? I would imagine it would have its challenges, right?
It does. And the short answer is this, and we haven't touched on this a whole lot, but when I say we drill a well, more specifically, what I'm saying is we've made the Village Drill available to drilling teams in Africa. So those teams, this is their business, is drilling wells. And so they never see myself or anybody from my organization. You know, a fun way to say it is that, you know, they never see a white man there saying, "Hey, I need your $2 this month." But quite literally, the obligation falls on the drill team to make that collection. And so they have contracts with the elders. The elders are responsible to go to all the community and have them, you know, pledge those dollars. And it does happen on occasion, but if they break their contract, then the drilling company can come and remove the hardware, remove the well part of it and take it away until the community, starts paying again. One of the most amazing things that we found, though, is that when a community does come together and the leadership explains what we're doing, and you know, before they have to make a huge investment, I think they usually just put down maybe 10 or 20%. But before they pay for the whole thing, they're going to have the well, so the well will be there for the majority of the time that they're paying for it, which is also very unique. But it also is not common, so we know that it comes with some liability and trust. And that's one of the biggest things is trust, right? Because if the village is, if they're paying somebody, they're like, well, who's getting those funds? Fortunately, now we're here in 2024, things like M-Pesa has made the challenge a lot easier. And because now we have irrefutable evidence of who paid, who hasn't paid, and they can't say, hey, I paid him and he didn't mark it down or something like that. And so that has definitely made the job of collecting the funds easier, but it's still a challenge. We have a large drilling crew up in Uganda that has the best track record. They collect over 85% of all the funds that are owed to them. And again, I think it's because of leadership. And then the communities can see, well, the neighboring community did it. and they still have their well, and everything is going good. So if they can do it, I think I can do it as well. But you're absolutely right. It is a struggle. And so we do everything in our power. The companies that are, you know, the Kenyans in Kenya that are doing this are, you know, the contracts are in place. They understand that this is not a charity. It is low cost and it is subsidized, but it's not a charity. So they're, because it would be very unusual, as we say, to have to pay back a charity. Matter of fact, this is one of the reasons that we don't even allow the communities to put our name on the well. You know, that's very, very popular to say, you know, this well was donated by so-and-so, and or if they have a tower, they'll paint the logo on the tower. And we don't even allow them to do that because, quite frankly, they paid for it. It's theirs. It's yeah, maybe we gave them a hand up. Maybe we helped a little bit, but it's theirs. And we want them to, every time they go to that well, to say, hey, I did this. Our community did this. And we want them to have that pride of ownership. And so that's, again, why we don't even allow them to, you know, to even paint our logo or put a plaque on that well. Because, again, the idea is that it's theirs. They came together as a community. And many, 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 probably 40% of those communities have gone beyond just doing the water. And they've come together as a community. And we've introduced other businesses. We've introduced raising tilapia or raising chickens or creating a brick making machine. Here's an irony. Most people didn't know this. I did not know this. But in order to make good bricks, you have to have clean water. You can't make strong bricks with dirty water.
Oh, wow.
I did not know that because you're mixing it with dirt, right? It didn't make sense. But that's one of those strange things where clean water really is the basis for really improving everything. It improves, obviously, the health. We like to put wells in at schools because then the girls can go to school all day and then maybe carry the water home with them at night. Or as the mamas are walking their kids to school, they can bring a jerry can back with them, you know, that day. And so that's when we talk to a community, we tell them, no, the best place is not next to the elder's home. The best place is where the community is going to be spending a lot of time or have easy access to, and schools are typically very, very high on that list.
Got it. And I really like that angle of ensuring ownership. Yes, they paid for it. So and I think it fosters sustainability because they know this is ours. We paid for it. It wasn't a donation. And so we're going to look after this and sort of protect our investment. I really like that. So let's move into...
Go ahead. And just to cap that off, because we know that 85% of the wells that have been put into operation on the African continent 5 years later are not working. And the biggest reason why is because a very well-meaning charity has gone in and put that well into place and took credit for it. But then when it broke, and when I say break, you know, typically it's just the seals that go bad and you have to replace the seals. It's less than a $20 fix. But yet the villages, instead of fixing it, because it's not theirs, if it's not theirs, they're not going to fix it. They're going to wait for that charity to come back and fix it themselves. Well, that charity has already moved on and they're not coming back. And so the men just tell their women, well, just go back to the rivers and we'll be fine just like we were before. Not understanding, and here's something that I just stress, because it's something that I figured out because of the immense amount of time that I spent in these villages. I would spend almost 5.5 months a year for 10 years in these remote villages. And I found in several communities that there was a population of children that was missing. And what I mean by that is that maybe there was 40 first graders and 50 second graders, but yet there was only 15 third graders, and then there was 40, you know, fourth graders and 50 fifth graders. I'm like, why the drop off on that year? And what I came to realize was that a well had been put into that village. It had been operating for, let's say, 3 or 4 years, and then it went bad. And then the women went back to the dirty rivers and the ponds and the streams to bring the water back. Well, all those children that had been born during and had only been weaned on clean water, didn't have the antibodies built up, and they got terribly sick drinking that dirty water. And a whole population of children, the mortality of that group of children was through the roof. And instead of being, 8 to 18%, it in some cases was as high as 85% mortality rate of those children when they had to go back and clean the and start drinking the dirty water without having those antibodies built up in their system. So it's important. It is massively important to, once you have that well, to have the ownership. So when it does break, they go and they have ownership and they'll fix it themselves.
That is such an incredibly important point. And I know you're not trying to throw shade at Mr. Beast.
No.
You must have heard that he drilled 50 plus boreholes here in, yes, in Kenya. So I hope he has a plan for making sure that they are maintained long after he's gone. So let's talk numbers. Because this podcast is really directed at people who are interested in health tech. And so they might be wondering, well, this is some engineering device. What has it got to do with health? Even though I'm sure you've already alluded to it. So let's talk impact. First of all, what kind of reach has the Village Drill had? Which countries is it operating in? And what kinds of health and other social impacts and societal impacts have you seen?
Yeah, that's been the real, for lack of a better way of saying it, the blessing on our side of why we do that. We actually have our technology in over 40 countries worldwide, 42 to be exact, and we have drilled over 14,500 wells with this technology. And if you assume somewhere between 800 to 1,000 people have access to that water, sometimes less, sometimes more, but on average, that's over 13 million people, typically in rural areas, typically where the big trucks couldn't even get to, even if they had the money to do it, that now have clean water. And again, the impact of the villages that have clean water is huge. Again, just with the women not being forced to walk down these dangerous paths. And we talk about, the life of somebody who is, and I use the word enslaved because they have no choice. They have to do this for their own survival and their own protection. But unfortunately, when these women are making these treks, they're going down very, very dangerous paths. There are very bad men who know these paths, and they'll wait for a vulnerable person to come, and then they'll either attack them, or we use the term sextortion. It says, well, in order to pass, you need to do this to me and pleasure me. And we also know that there's wild animals. They can twist an ankle. They can break a leg. They can hurt their back. A lot of things can happen during these journeys. If we can reduce that, that's one of the first impacts, is that the health of these girls, the opportunity for them to go to school, the opportunity for the women to become industrious. Instead of fetching water all day, they could be making pottery or mats or something that can add an economic value to their community. What, maybe it's just farming. Maybe it's their own farm that they can now, put some more time into. So that's the first, and the largest impact. And again, all these things stem from clean water, the better health, the opportunity of the industry. It all. The baseline is clean water.
Got you. Very, very impressive numbers. And when we talk about social determinants of health, this is exactly what we are talking about. And access to clean water is exactly one of those very key components of the social determinants of health. So, what keeps you up at night as far as scaling the Village Drill is concerned?
Our biggest challenge, and this is going to be a little bit counterintuitive, but our biggest challenge are the people who are just giving things away. And because we know when you give something away, it just creates more dependency. And even though I think they're doing it with a big heart and in many cases for the right reasons, but unfortunately, it creates more dependency and it doesn't solve the core problem. And again, hey, I've spent a lot of time in Africa. I think there is a message in more developed communities that the people that live in these rural areas, well, they don't have the skills that we have. And I find that is wrong. They are just as smart, they're just as industrious, but they need the opportunity. And they've been given this false narrative that it's good to be given things. And one of the most eye-opening experiences that the people from our organization have is when we go to a school where the community has come together and have, let's say, put a well into that school in which they paid for it. Because we had two very, very stark experiences. One, there was a politician who paid for a well to be placed in a school. The other place that we visited, and we visited with 10 or 15 Americans, and we went to the first school where the politician had given them a well. And when we got there, after all the pleasantries, and of course, they're going to give you a dance and do some beautiful entertainment for you. But then all of a sudden, it was all the asks. Well, we need this. We need rows. We need books. We need, and the asking for things from our organization almost became unbearable. Now, contrast that to the school where the community all came together and they paid for it. And we went there. And after the same, opening ceremonies and the dancing and the singing, they took us by the hand and they wanted to show us everything that they have done. And they went and they showed us the 10 acres of crops that they had planted. And they wanted to show us where they created a piggery, where they're now raising pigs. And the last place, well, there's two more. One was chickens, where they start out raising, laying eggs. And they went from laying eggs to actually selling chicks to the community and then selling broilers. And it was amazing that there wasn't a single ask because the community had developed all these industries and they were able to fix all their problems themselves. The only difference between those two scenarios was ownership and pride of ownership. And I can tell you 100 stories that are almost identical to that around the world. It doesn't matter where you're at. I have the same stories in Haiti and in the Philippines and in Vanuatu and many other countries in Africa as well. But it really does stem from, and I think it goes down to that, to teach a man to, give a man a fish, he eats for a day, teach a man to fish, he'll eat for a lifetime. I think that's what we're trying to instill. These people are not incapable, but they need to be taught that there's a different way, a better way, than just looking for the handout.
No, that resonates very strongly. And coincidentally, I'm about to publish an opinion piece addressing charities and calling on them to move away from this very dependency-creating model to a model of empowerment. Because, like you said, there's a lot of invisibilization of the capacity and the agency in many of these communities. And that's because of this mindset that we have that people need to be saved and people need to be rescued and they don't have agency. Whereas if we really thought about it critically, there is agency, but like someone says, if you judge an elephant by its ability to climb a tree, of course it'll fail woefully, right? Judge it by what it can do. And I think that's the mindset we need to have. So let's end on this note. If I was a policymaker in Africa, let's say in the Ministry of, Environment and Sanitation or the Ministry of Health or some local municipality, right? What one ask would you have of me as it pertains to the village drill?
I'm gonna expand that beyond the village drill. And I'm going to ask those people that have the power of change to look within. And we're guilty of this. Everybody's guilty of this, but here in America, we're guilty of this, where we spend so much money on talking about the issue. I can't tell you how many times I get invited to this meeting or that meeting or this conference or that conference. And there's so much talking going on and so many promises going on, but yet the root problem never gets addressed. And what I would tell these policymakers is to find the organizations that are actually attacking the root cause and are working to end the root cause, and you know, and go beyond the academic obvious of, oh, we just need more education. You need somebody to create an easier way for, you know, somebody to get health care. If I break an arm, is there a way to, you know, can we, you know, how can we, you know, how can we solve those problems internally and not look for a big handout, or don't be satisfied with just, you know, going to another conference and pretending as if you're solving the problem, but actually find those groups and take the money that you're saving and reward those innovators, reward those women who say, hey, I think if we did this, I think we'd have a huge impact. Those ideas exist. Give people in your community the ability to take those ideas and make them flourish.
Well, on that very wise and inspiring note, I'd just like to say thank you so much, John, for spending the time. I must say you are an amazing storyteller, and I really enjoyed learning about your work. And look, whenever you're in Kenya, please, please look me up.
Sam, this has been my pleasure. It's always great to chat with you, and I consider myself a fellow Nairobian.
Yeah, indeed.
having spent a lot of time there, many trips. It's my second home. My wife says it's my first home, and that here is my second home. But I love your community. I love your people, and they've always made me feel so welcome. So thank you again. It's always great to chat with you, and I really appreciate what MedTech Africa is doing and the impact that it's having. You have a great podcast. You got great followers, and again, let's keep on spreading the word and getting the information out to people to make a true difference, to have an impact in this world.
Thank you, John. Take care.
All right, Sam. All right, have a great day.
You too.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. MedTech Africa is produced and hosted by Sam Oti and co-edited by yours truly, Veronica Sander Ochambo. The goal of MedTech Africa is to provide a platform for showcasing digital health and health tech innovations across the African continent. Please reach out to us if you have any thoughts on this episode or recommendations of African health innovators that you'd like us to host on the show. You can find our contact details in the episode show notes. Finally, be sure to subscribe to MedTech Africa on your preferred podcast platform. And if you have a moment, please leave us a great review, because it really helps other people to find the show. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you join us in our next episode.